You're listening to the 40 Thrive Podcast, the show created for women 40 and beyond, ready to shake things up. And now, your host, Jackie McDougall.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of 40 Thrive. Today on the podcast, I'm talking with Ada Calhoun. She's author of the New York Times bestseller, Why We Can't Sleep, Women's New Midlife Crisis. And this book is an expansion, actually, of a viral story she wrote for Oprah.com a while back and realized how much women in midlife need this content. And the book is a, quote, generation-defining exploration of the new midlife crisis facing Gen X women and the unique circumstances that have brought them to this point. Ada and I talk about the catalyst for writing the book, what she was really surprised by, and the mental load we women over 40 take on that is unheard of and unlike any other generation. If you haven't yet read this book, it is linked to in the show notes, and you can actually listen to it for free on Audible. So just go to audibletrial.com/40thrive and get a free audiobook download and free trial of Audible. That's audibletrial.com/40thrive. You definitely want to check out this book. I love to listen to books, as I've mentioned many times before, because I can just get it done wherever I am. Yesterday, I was walking around Costco with my earbuds in, listening to her and like responding out loud. I think people thought I was losing my mind. I was in the car and I was getting teary. I'll talk about that in the interview. I could not stop listening to it. And so you're definitely going to want to check it out. Okay, before we get into it, I have to tell you some giant news. So you now can support the 40 Thrive podcast. That's right. We are on Patreon, which is this really cool site where you can support creatives out there and all the work that they're doing. And support starts at just $3 a month. So go to the show notes, 40thrive.com/episode60. And you'll see all the information about it. But at $3 a month, you can be a patron and you'll get a shout out. Or at $10 a month, you can join the 40 Thrive Book Club, which is a brand new thing coming out. And coming soon, you'll have an opportunity to join our 40 Thrive membership. This is a monthly experience with expert workshops, with midlife masterminds hosted by moi, and we'll be supporting each other, holding each other accountable. Here's the thing. The 40 Thrive membership is all focused on work, wealth, and wellness. Those are the three specific areas that women over 40 have been sharing with me that are really important to them and where they need the most support. So I am creating this membership site to help you in these areas and give you access to experts who will help you take everything to the next level. This is the perfect way to level up your life, focusing on work, wealth, and wellness. Okay, that's not open quite yet, but definitely stay tuned. In the meantime, you can support at the $3 level or join the 40 Thrive Book Club at the $10 level. Check out 40thrive.com/episode60 to make that happen. Okay, so back to the show. Here's my conversation with Ada Calhoun. Ada, welcome to the 40 Thrive podcast.
Thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome. So you must, first of all, be exhausted. I have a little Google, you know, one of those little Google alerts for anytime somebody writes about women over 40, just so I can serve my community. And I have one for midlife, and that's how I find a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Every single day, there is an article written about your book.
Oh, you must be so bored of me.
I'm not. I was like, how? I feel like the last person, but I'm excited that you're here.
Oh, well, I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, I think that you have pulled together women over 40 in a club that we are thrilled to be a part of, and yet no one wants to be a part of.
Well, it's a good way to put it. It's complicated.
Yeah. So take us back, though, to the beginning. This all came about because of an article on Oprah, correct?
Yes, correct. On Oprah.com. So an editor called me. It was the summer of 2017. And she said she was trying to get someone to write about women of our generation mm-hmm. in midlife and what was going on with us because she suspected there was something afoot. So she gave me like 3 months to work on it. And it ran at like 6,000 words on Oprah.com. And there was this real flood of messages following that. And just the readership was kind of ridiculous. It was like hundreds of thousands of Facebook shares in a couple of days.
Wow.
And so we realized, oh, this like touched a nerve. So I got asked to do it as a book after that.
That's great. You were tapping into something that you were also going through. So how did you feel about the idea of writing a book and spending all of that time diving into something you were maybe struggling with?
It was great because it helped me more than anything else had. Just hearing other women's stories and doing all this research, everything that I learned made me feel less alone and better. And I felt like the more I learned, the more I understood it and the less I was blaming myself. And that was really helpful.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I was listening to it on Audible, which is my favorite way to consume mm-hmm. books these days.
I do that a lot too.
And by the way, you read it like it was really, really well read because I'm super specific when I listen good. To things. I'm like, oh, okay, she's good. but I turned to my husband and I said, you know, the good news is I'm not that special. Mm. And I said, the bad news is I'm not that special. And so it gave me sort of a two-sided, I'm not in this alone, mm-hmm. and maybe it's not going to get better. And so I was like listening and listening and listening, hoping that at some point it would get better. And we're going to get to that in a little bit. But what were you most surprised by in writing this book?
I think it was the language women used all over the country. So I interviewed a really diverse group of a couple hundred women. And at some point in the conversation, they almost all used some of the same phrases. One of them was, I have no right to complain. I'm so lucky. And another one was, what did I do wrong? And I thought that was so interesting that here are these women, a lot of whom were very successful, a lot of whom had these beautiful families, or that, you know, they had a lot going for them. And a lot of them were very funny and charming and interesting in all these different ways. And yet there was this self-recrimination and also this tendency to feel like they should not be acknowledging how hard things were.
Right. Why do you think that is, that we feel it necessary to remind everybody that even though we're struggling, we feel so lucky and grateful? Because I do it.
I think we almost all do it. I think part of it is the same reason why women get accused of apologizing all the time. Mm. I think there's this, I mean, I think it's been reinforced culturally for so long, this idea that, first of all, that if you have a roof over your head, if you have food in the refrigerator, that should be good enough and you should just appreciate it. And I also, I think that like so much of the self-help jargon now emphasizes gratitude, which I think is interesting. I think a lot of times it does work and gets you out of a slump and all that. But there's this flip side to it, which is that, you know, sometimes things are really bad and really hard. And maybe the appropriate response in that moment is not gratefulness. Maybe it's anger.
Right. You touch upon it in the book and I have felt it, but the level of rage that I've been
yeah. you know,
able to feel. I mean, I went into menopause at 35 mm-hmm. because of surgery. And so I'm not necessarily the same as a lot of the women in your book or in my community. The one thing you do mention too is like a lot of the surgeries that are not necessary that mm-hmm. I think some of us are going through. Mine was preventative because I have a BRCA gene and all that.
But, oh, yeah.
But the rage and the anger, and yet just to go back to the gratitude, I feel like it's important. I feel like
yeah.
having gratitude, that it's a game changer because you can,
totally.
You know, it actually makes us a little bit happier in that if I'm in LA traffic and I am stuck for 2 hours, which absolutely sucks and is not unheard of, I can say like, but here's the what's the reason for the traffic? Somebody is going through something much worse than this. And so mm-hmm. I can sort of keep it in perspective.
Totally.
But I think that part of us as women over 40 are doing that because if we don't, we're never going to get out of bed in the morning.
No, it's true. And I think it can help to see what you have and not just focus on what you don't have. Because a lot of the women that I interviewed at the same time they were writing gratitude journals, they also felt like they were not doing enough, even if they were doing many, many, many things.
Yes, I completely related to that statement. And why do you think that is? Because the women who raised us weren't doing that to themselves.
One thing that I heard over and over again in these interviews was that women were living out the dreams of their mothers, that their mothers were not able to do as much, didn't have as many opportunities. And so they really instilled this idea in us that we should take advantage of every opportunity that we are presented with and look at how many choices you have. And one woman told me that her mother would say things like, you know, oh, don't be a nurse, be a doctor. You can do so much more. And I think what happened to our generation was that pressure to reach for the stars and achieve more and more and more was coupled with a real lack of support. So it's one thing to say, go be a doctor, and for that person to then pay for medical school and to do all these things and introduce you to doctors. And it's another thing to say, go be a doctor, and then you're on your own to try to figure out how to make that happen, which is what happened to so many women in our generation. And they blame themselves for then not becoming the doctor.
Right. Isn't that interesting? You know, it's funny because Diane Wingard, who's been on my show a couple times, she's a life coach, and she is very clear with recognizing when something's an opportunity or just an option. I think sometimes as women, we're like, oh, look at that opportunity, I better take it. And it's not necessarily an opportunity, it's just an option. And you can actually skip it if you choose to.
Right. And it's funny, I read this story someone wrote about my book and also about Little Women, and where she said, like, as soon as you pick something, the other options go away. So even if you go in with like kind of an infinite number of choices, once you make a choice, your field narrows a lot. And I think maybe we were blindsided by that too. Like, once you have kids, you can't not have kids. Once you get married, you can't never be married. Like, they're things that you choose, and they change things.
That's true. And I see on the flip side, I see a lot of women at this age and stage who don't make decisions because they're so afraid that it's the wrong decision.
Totally. I mean, I heard that so many times in interviews. And I think one friend of mine in the book says something like, well, you know, what if I choose wrong? You know, and I go through all the effort of going back to school and doing all these things and all the upheaval that would involve for the family. And then what if it's the wrong choice and I don't want to do it? And then I'll be 10 years older and how horrible that will be.
Right. One of the things I try to remind people is that you're going to be 10 years older no matter what you do. And so holding off and not making a decision is making a decision.
That's true. It's a good point.
It's scary. But let's talk about the fact that we have all of these opportunities and we're trying to grab hold of all of them. And yet at home, okay, I'll fully admit when you started talking about the mental load of middle-aged women, I just started to cry in my car. No, and that's a good thing, because I think sometimes we think that we're so alone. And of course I brought every single chapter to my husband to talk about. And then I told him that he probably shouldn't listen to this episode. So from little things, from, you know, IEPs for special needs kids, to even our voting was mail in. And it's like, I gotta make sure that my husband, remind him to mail, you know, send in his vote, and all of just the little things that if you look at, and this is a stereotype, but it's there for a reason. If you look at my email or a woman's email and you look at the husband's, you know, maybe if you have just a heterosexual marriage here, wife's emails, husband's emails. I could go into my husband's emails and it's like 90% work, maybe 9% spam that he doesn't delete, which makes me crazy, and 1% just something else that he gets. Like,
right.
I get all of the social emails, you know, all of the kid stuff that we have to actually respond to, you know, all of that other stuff. So he looks at my calendar and he's like, you get more done by 8 a.m. than I get done all day. And I'm like, that's only what's on the calendar.
Yeah, it's good he sees it. I think a lot of this kind of work that women do is invisible, and it's done maybe even without thinking about it often, so that no one notices. And people are able to take it for granted or to poke fun at the PTA moms or this kind of thing. It's like, no, women in their 40s and 50s are like keeping the whole country running on a daily basis.
Yes. And I think that, yes, he sees it because I slap him in the face with it, but it doesn't change that it continues to happen. Does that happen? I mean, you are going through all of these things that you're writing about, and you're writing about it, and you have a kid. Like, were you going through all of this while you were writing about it?
Yeah. And I was desperately trying to add my husband onto the email list about the kids, like for the school. I kept adding him like every time an email came through, and then he just kept dropping off. And I was like, this is so interesting. And like, he's not unpopular, but it's like, it was always all moms. They never did have a man on that email list. And so, yeah, no, I was going through it. My husband was like so nice and so helpful the whole time I was working on the book, I think because he didn't want to show up in the book in a negative way. So this is a good strategy that anybody can steal is write a book, or at least pretend
ladies,
to write a
everyone
book.
Write a book right now. That's funny. But has that continued since you finished the book?
He's still nice. I'm still on book tour, so we'll see once I stop talking about it. But no, he's very helpful. And it's funny, though, because he is extremely helpful. He does a lot of cooking and cleaning and taking care of the kid. And it makes it possible to go on book tour and not have to worry. So I'm, again, super grateful. I have no right to complain. But it is true that there are things that I think by default just fall to the women in relationships, like you mentioned, the emails and the school stuff and all that. And it's extremely hard to transfer that off onto men.
Yeah. You know, it's funny that you talk about him and then you say how helpful he is. And this morning we were driving the three kids to school and my husband was going to take the high schooler. And he said, you know, I want to make things easier on you. And it actually sort of set me off because I was like, when did these children become mine? Like, aren't they your kids too? And in some ways I give them a lot of credit because our dads weren't necessarily, you know, that generation wasn't as hands-on. My father was not one to change a diaper.
Right.
And my husband was. But at the same time, we still have these roles that when they do something, it's to help us out.
Right.
And not to be a contributing partner. Do you find that everywhere?
Well, what's so funny to me is exactly what you mentioned about the boomer dads. Like, they didn't change diapers. They didn't help at all. Gen X men do so much more. And I think that we then are in this position of congratulating them for it and saying like, oh, we're so lucky. Thank you so much. When you look at time use studies, though, women still do the vast majority of all that kind of work. So the household stuff and the childcare and the caregiving for aging relatives and things like that. So I think it's, in a way, it puts Gen X women in a double bind where at once they're getting more help than their mothers did, and yet they have to kind of perform their gratitude for that help so much more than is proportional to the amount of actual assistance they're receiving.
Right. But you even talk about in the book that the mothers before weren't bringing in equal or even more income at times.
Indeed.
And that was their role that they had agreed to, I would think, in many cases, not all. And so now we're doing more. And yes, thank you guys. I'll schedule the parade as soon as humanly possible. But we're you know, we're doing the work and we're doing the work at home.
That's
and
right.
So how do you fix that? Can you fix that?
Well, what's so funny to me is this idea that we thought this was going to work out. Like, I think when women like marched into the workplace, like if men had an equal numbers, marched home to take care of everything there, I think it all would have worked fine. I think we wouldn't be so tired. And that didn't happen at all. So we just added a lot of responsibility without really taking anything off our plate.
Right. And then we're hysterical or angry or, you know, must be that time of the month or perimenopause when we don't want to put up with it anymore.
Yeah. Well, and I think that is one thing that I hope is changing, is that we're able to look at it and say, like, this is, you know, we were sold a bill of goods. This was not actually a workable plan. There was no plan, and we need to do something now.
Yeah. And I think millennials, and you touch upon this a little bit in the book, like, I think they have a better grasp.
Yeah. They're more realistic.
They are. And they have a little more balance. They don't, you know, they don't beat themselves up for every single thing. Like, I remember, so I've done all of it. I've worked from home. I've worked in the office full time. I've worked in the office part time. I've been stay at home only. Like, I've done all of the roles, and my responsibilities at home never change.
Yeah, exactly.
No matter which role I'm doing. Maybe when I'm working full time, I can bring somebody in to clean the house every other week.
Yeah.
But that's basically all that really changes. And I think millennials, like, then we'll beat ourselves up that we weren't at the tea party at school.
Right.
You know, and so millennials, I've noticed, are like, I'm only one person.
Yeah. Yeah.
What a concept.
I do think that they tend to put up with less. And it's funny because I think a lot of the stereotypes about them in the workplace involve them advocating for their own needs in ways that are just anathema to Gen Xers. I think about the things I've dealt with in jobs and just thought were like, well, you know, price of doing business. And millennials don't seem to be willing to make those kind of concessions.
Yeah, it's so true. I worked with a millennial years ago, a few years back, who didn't work on Wednesdays. And I said to her, like, oh, do you have kids? Like, what's your... She said, no, I can't be as creative as I like to be if I work 5 days in a row. So I do the two and two. And I'm like, looking around thinking I'm going to be punked, you know. So Ashton really Kutcher funny. At the time is coming out, you know. And I'm like, that's fascinating. And she sets these boundaries and then companies just agree to them.
It's amazing.
It's unbelievable. And we're in our 40s and 50s and later when we're starting to realize that we actually matter.
Mm-hmm.
And then we call them entitled.
Yeah, I think that's right. And also, I do think that there is some depressing stuff happening with women in their 50s and the sort of ageism that you see where there is this priority for like the creative young people who maybe are cheaper. And I do think it can be hard. And a lot of the women I interviewed told me to insist on your own value in the face of workplaces that often don't see it.
Right. But that's really hard to do, don't you think?
Hardest thing.
Because if the company doesn't see the value, it's easier for them to just not take a chance.
Yeah, exactly. Especially if you want to be paid what you're worth. And if you have a lot of experience in the field and like you're valuable, that means expensive usually.
Right. And I actually was on a call yesterday with a potential client. You know, I had to talk to a few people in the office before we could agree to work together. And the first thing she said to me, she must have had my resume in front of her, but it was a young woman and she's super creative and smart and, you know, somebody I would enjoy working with. Mm-hmm. The first thing she said to me was, wow, you've been working for as long as I've been alive.
Oh, God. That's one of those like taboo things that you should just not say out loud, I think.
Yeah, but I think that she doesn't have necessarily the experience in leadership and in management to know right. what to say and what not to say. But it was up to me in that moment to take that as, you know what? I'm a boss. Mm-hmm. I know some things and you could learn from me and I am more than happy to be a mentor. Like otherwise right. I would have just shriveled up and died.
Yes. No, I think that's the appropriate response is to be like, yep, you know, that's why you need me.
Yeah, it was a tough moment that I was like, oh my gosh, what do I do? Do I like just shrivel? Like, you know, so you've officially brought us all together. I know you have my group talking. You have so many women over 40 everywhere. We're like, I'm creating a book club because of you, because I think more and more women just need this in our lives to have these open conversations with each other.
I agree with that.
Because we weren't and now we are, and that's great. And I want to keep it going because
yes.
otherwise it's going to be like, oh, look at this amazing book. And then a year from now, we're talking about something else, you know, yeah. The Bachelor. And I don't want to go back to that. I want to have these real conversations. So you brought us together. You've given us this like ownership over this time of our lives. What do we do with it?
I just think acknowledging all these forces at work is the first really huge step. I think that we've been brainwashed into thinking that the way things are is the only way things can be, and into thinking that if we just, you know, get on the right diet or cleanse or exercise program or self-help book scheme, that we're going to fix it for ourselves and it's going to be, it's all going to be fine from then on. And it's not true. There are so many systemic and cultural and ingrained issues that I just think it's so much bigger than any one of us can fix.
Right. And so we've all acknowledged it. The fact that, especially I related to your story because I'm freelance. I worked in television for many years. Mm-hmm. I was about to have my first child in 2004 and decided not to sign the contract. That was, you know, more money than I had ever made. And I still, to this day, and I just talked about it on a past episode, have that contract. And like, I sometimes wonder, wow, did I shoot myself in the foot by not continuing in? And you talk about that for women who kind of like lean out or step out. And I wasn't necessarily not working. So it was great in that I was able to innovate into digital and into podcasting and teaching and consulting and all of that. But it's not the same as that, you know, mid six figure job with the health insurance and the stability, so to speak, you know, And so you live that life too. Like, what would you tell other women who are trying to continue in this gig economy at our age? Like, how can they either recreate themselves or just market themselves in a way that others will find valuable? Because it's great if we find value, but if others don't, we don't work.
I think it's an illusion that those mid-figure fancy jobs are stable. I mean, having seen one friend after another deal with layoffs, and actually people who were in the gig economy were much more nimble, and there's a real advantage to that, and there's an advantage to being around for your kids. And you know, I think about it too, where I sometimes see like little kids and I'm like, oh, I wanted more kids, like, but then I realize there's no way that I could have been really present for my son, who I do have, and do 3 books of my own and all these other things if I had other kids when I started thinking about it again. And I just think this idea that we can do all the things is an illusion, and that it's okay. Like, I just think that a lot of women I interviewed had this idea ingrained in their head that if they didn't do all the things and do them all perfectly, that they were letting down not only themselves, but their mothers and the culture at large. Because here we were, we had so many advantages. Of course we can have a family and a 6-figure job and, you know, 20 other things. But no one can. And people who do often are suffering in other ways, like they can't sleep, or that, you know, or they're tired all the time, or something, because it's not feasible.
Right. Have you found the ability in writing this to take a step back and not do all the things, or are you still doing all the things?
I mean, I do a lot of the things, but I don't do them all well. I'm glad you can't see my whole apartment, which I'm looking at right now. It's a very small apartment, so there are a lot of things that I don't do or have, and I'm much more reconciled to that now than I was before I did the book.
Yeah, I think at least for me. So my kids, I have 3 teenage boys, and I'm
amazing. Almost, first of all,
thank you. And I'm almost 49 next month in a few weeks, and I think that trying to do all the things was making me absolutely miserable. Mm-hmm. And I still, you know, we all need to work. Many of us need to work, and I enjoy my work, and I love coaching and consulting and all of that. But I also have given myself a little bit of a break. Mm-hmm. And I've discovered that my kids can actually learn more from my boundaries and my limits than from my trying to do everything.
I think that's very sane and admirable.
Well, thank you. And I also have 10 older siblings that I have seen, especially my sisters who range from 10 years older to 15 years older, 4 of them. And, you know, the different ways that they approached parenting and work and all of that, and not necessarily feeling like they have to be all things to all people. And so sometimes you just have to be around those people who have broken through.
Totally.
and follow them. I just want to talk about alcohol for a second. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when we first have kids and we have, you know, play dates, and if we're even doing that, but wine and alcohol is very much part of the conversation.
Yeah.
Mommy juice. And, you know, I mean, I'm guilty of it too. Like, people would come over with their kids and I would pour glasses of wine. And now at my age, like, it doesn't work for me anymore. Like, it actually makes me a little bit more agitated, or maybe it's a blood sugar thing. Like, oh God, it's so unsexy. Do you find that women over 40, their relationship with what you call booze, you know, it has changed?
For a lot of them it has, especially because of the sleep thing. And that's something that I've noticed too, is like, if I go have drinks, then it's inevitable that I'll wake up at 4 in the morning. The comedian Bridget Everett calls it the Chardonnay shocker. I wake up at 4 a.m. And
that's funny.
Yeah.
When it's
wearing off. And and I do think there was a great essay by Christy Coulter about when she quit drinking, how she noticed that all the women around her were just drunk all the time. She thought because they needed some kind of social lubricant to not look at how hard everything was and how frustrated they were in all these different ways. So I think when it's used, as I think it often is with women of our generation, as a way to smooth things over and not look at the problems, I think it can be problematic.
Yeah. And I've seen that in that it's our way of coping, right? Until mm-hmm. until it's not.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Until we realize that it's not helping us cope at all. Because I actually lose my, you know, my patience when if I have two glasses of wine and you annoy me, I will let you know in no uncertain terms. And I realize like that's not fair to my kids because I was inconsistent. And so I recently, you know, I didn't quit altogether, but the wine at home thing,
yeah.
you know, I was like, yeah, that's not really serving me anymore. Going out to yeah. dinner with friends or whatever it is and having a couple of glasses of wine is fine. But I realized that it wasn't serving me. And I think that that's one of the things you're giving women permission to do is to really look at what's not serving them in their lives
right.
and make some changes.
Yeah. Yeah. And it could be anything. I mean, and it's different for everyone. That's why I think it's hard to give advice. And a lot of times, you know, I've gotten like questions about the book that are like, well, okay, what do we do? Like, what's the game plan? What's the takeaway? Give me the list of things to add to the shopping list. And I just think you could give one woman the advice to like drink more because you just need some kind of outlet and to feel a little wild occasionally. And then you give, you know, her next door neighbor the advice to stop drinking. You know, if she's looking hard at her life, I think she could see something very different than what the person who looks from the outside like her life is very similar would need.
Right. And as far as the reaction to the book, what has been the reaction versus how you would like the response to be?
Oh, I have no expectations about these things. I mean, having written a few books before, the fact that people are reading it makes me so happy and grateful that I would never, you know, never say that people are doing it wrong. And I've been really ecstatic that I keep getting these messages from people who say that it helped them see things more clearly. I'd say like a few times a day that they feel seen, to use the millennial mm-hmm. term, or less alone. And I think that's the greatest gift any writer can get. I mean, I feel like almost everything I've ever written has been an attempt to feel less alone myself and make people feel less alone. So the fact that this book seems to be having that effect on a lot of people makes me very happy.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Do you feel like that is the ultimate goal, is feeling less alone? Do you feel like there's any hope in the book that we can change all of the things just by acknowledging them?
I think there is hope in the book. I hope there is hope in the book. I think the feeling less alone is the first step, but I do think anything in the culture that's going to help women as a whole try to do all the things they're trying to do will be good. So I think the fact that that we're trying to do all these things without maternity leave, without healthcare, just like a million really commonsensical necessities to get through a life at this stage. I hope that we can look at that harder.
Right. So what's next for you?
I'm still traveling. Like the bad thing about having a book do well is the same as the good thing, because it's like I'm just really busy talking about the book. So So I don't know. I've got a contract to do an audio thing about this poet Frank O'Hara that I'm actually mm-hmm. very excited to do, but I don't know when I'm going to get to it. Probably in a couple months when things right. calm down.
Well, I applaud you and appreciate you for. Just by writing this book, you are living that message that you can still do important work, that you still can find your voice, my whole jam is helping women find their voice.
Yeah.
And so by writing this book and letting women feel less alone and maybe understand themselves a little bit more and understand mm-hmm. also that it's not solely our fault that right. the generation we've been really brainwashed into believing certain things that we didn't even know were coming yes. from outside, you know, forces.
Exactly.
And so for you to write this, for you to say like, hey, I'm living in this freelance world where I really applaud that you talking about like thinking, oh, I can go on vacation because these things are coming in and then these things don't come in. And mm-hmm. many, many, many of us live like that. Where it's so feast or famine.
Totally.
And we try to pretend, I mean, look at social media. We try to pretend that like, oh, everything's so great. I'm freelance and I'm a consultant. And so that way I can be with my kids and be professional and amazing. Right. And at times you don't see your kids because you're writing a book.
Right.
Or you're not making the money and you're wondering when the next check is coming from, you know, where it's coming from. And so I appreciate that you're opening up that world, but also you just kept going. You just, you wrote the book and now you, the book tour, I can't even imagine how exhausting it must be doing podcast after podcast and article and TV. And it's one of those things like, be careful what you wish for. I mean, it's amazing and it helps with the success of your project, but at the same time, it's another way, just like what you wrote about, it's another way that you kind of get your ass kicked.
Well, I'm not about to complain about it because I, you know, it's having done a lot of things in the past that got no attention. I can say that is worse than this.
Yes.
So if I get sleepy on the road occasionally, it is a small price to pay for actually getting the word out about something that I care about.
You're grateful and you have nothing to complain about.
Exactly. That's the message I would like to leave you with.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate talking with you. Thank you so much, Ada. And thank you for listening. If you're struggling during this stage of life, you are not alone. Whether you join us in the 40 Thrive online community or you find a therapist in your area, there is help and support out there. And if you need help finding someone, please email me at hello@40thrive.com. I'm more than happy to help you find the resources you need. And please consider sharing this episode with a friend. You know the one she really needs to know that she's not alone right now. Until next time, take care and keep thriving. Spring has sprung, and with the change of seasons, sometimes comes an increase in vitality. If you're feeling in the mood for a little more personal time, may I suggest Coconut? Coconut is all about providing clean and natural ingredients when you're enjoying your most intimate moments, with or without a partner. Naturally safe products developed by people who are obsessed with quality. Get 15% off with promo code GRONASS at grownasswoman.guide/coconut. That's 15% off with promo code GRONASS at grownasswoman.guide/coconut.